That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about, our government is in trouble. They say, the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts, our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day.
Well, that was a clip from Malcolm X's speech, Message to the Grassroots. Joining us for this segment is William Sales, Jr., to talk about Malcolm X and the Black Liberation Movement, the relevance of his ideological and political points on the situation of black people today. Dr. Sales is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Seton Hall University. He's authored the most extensive study to date on Malcolm X's Organization of African American Unity, From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Organization of African American Unity. And he was co-convener of the first international conference on Malcolm X, held in New York City in 1990. Joining us today is William. How are you doing, William?
Fine, Tammy. How are you?
I'm doing good. Well, you just heard of that clip of Malcolm X. So let's start off with what's unique about Malcolm X politics. Can you elaborate on Malcolm X, not just as a black nationalist, but the revolutionary black nationalist? Malcolm, as you wrote, as an outsider trying to bring down the system, not join it. Malcolm X as the Pan-African internationalist.
Malcolm X gave voice to what at that time was a newly emerging social force in the United States, and those were the increasingly dispossessed urban black people in inner-city ghettos. The civil rights movement had articulated demands that benefited all African Americans because it dismantled legalized Jim Crow and discrimination. That was an important historical mission to be accomplished. But as we were accomplishing that mission, it became more and more evident that increasing numbers, in fact, the majority of African American people, were being subjected to a new and different kind of oppression, which wasn't legalized discrimination as much as it was de facto institutionalized racism experienced inside of inner city ghettos. And so Malcolm articulated the needs of that newly emerging group, and rather than being unique in that sense, what was unique was that for the first time, people had to listen to the demands of ordinary ghettoized black folks as articulated by Malcolm X. That was one very important thing he did. A second very important thing that Malcolm facilitated was the reintroduction of the black radical nationalist tradition into the black liberation struggle. That is, there have been throughout the experience of black people in this country at least two alternative ways of dealing with oppression. One has been to struggle for assimilation, that is, to remove all barriers to assimilation into the American mainstream. But the other very important trend has been to demand recognition for the legitimacy of what earlier commentators called our place in the sun, that is, for an independent national existence. And Malcolm represented that liberation thrust coming into the civil rights movement. And it wasn't so much that he was the first to originate it, but what he did was to reintroduce that tradition into the discourse. So that was important. A third thing that Malcolm did that was crucial was that he expanded the parameters of the civil rights movement. And in so doing, he transformed that movement from a domestically oriented movement for civil rights into an internationally oriented movement for human rights. What he was trying to do was to hook up the struggle of black people in this country to the worldwide struggle of peoples of color against all forms of racist colonialism and imperialism and monopoly capitalism in the world. So he saw, for instance, the OAAU as a regional counterpart of the Organization of African Unity, and it's interesting that May is African Liberation Month, as it is also the month within which we celebrate the birthday of Malcolm X. It was in that context that Malcolm wanted to take the United States before the World Court and the United Nations and indict them for violations of the human rights of African American people. He hoped to do this with the support of revolutionary leadership in the Third World. So, you know, there are a number of ways that we can talk about Malcolm's intervention in the movement. He was a different kind of a leader compared to the civil rights leadership. Malcolm certainly had charisma, but his leadership was not based solely or primarily so much in terms of charisma. He was what we might call an organic intellectual. He led by virtue of his experiences in the struggle and his willingness to take an upfront position and struggle uncompromisingly against racism in this country.
You know, we opened up the segment with Malcolm's agitation around the House Negro and the Field Negro mm-hmm. dialectic. Can you elaborate? Because he was talking about the black liberation movement expanding it, but he also presented the class contradictions within, inside the black community.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we talk about Malcolm as articulating the needs of a newly emerging strata, what we see reflected here is the maturation of internal divisions among African Americans, which have their origins as far back as slavery. And so what Malcolm did in a very accessible way is talk about the implications of those class divisions. That is, those slaves who bore the brunt of oppression had the kind of consciousness as a rule that would reflect their actual position in the field, whereas those who were in the house, so to say, reflected the assimilationist forces which were bearing upon them. And these differences in the actual nature of oppression had a whole lot to do with the consciousness and the possible role that these groups would play. As we move forward into the latter part of the 20th century with Malcolm, what we see is he says that the center of gravity in the struggle for black liberation has to be in those black people who are most oppressed and who are in the most uncompromising position. It is not that other groups or strata of the black community don't feel oppression and racism, but the middle-class black person is not in the same strategic position that a ghettoized African is to respond to that oppression, to be uncompromising and struggling against it, and to push the historic process through to its logical conclusion.
Well, before we talk about the implications for present day, let's talk some about Malcolm's demands. I mean, mm-hmm. in that same very speech, he talked about revolution being based on land, mm-hmm. Land as the basis of all independence. And in your own writing, you've talked a lot about black sovereignty. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we understand the U.S. to be a settler state built on the genocide of Native Americans, the enslavement of African American people, and the whole exploitation. So that it's not a unified state, but much more a multinational state. Yeah. So what would those demands mean in terms of actually thinking about a black nation inside the U.S.? And then that means what are the demands that we're setting across and trying to, similar to what you were saying, the organic intellectual, let's build on that and thinking outside thinkable thoughts. Let's have some counter-hegemonic demands.
Okay. First, I think it's important to recognize that when one talks about self-determination from the perspective that Malcolm brings to the struggle, you're talking about a collective demand. Many times when you talk about civil rights, you're talking about demands that can be realized simply by individuals. Individuals, you know, who are now allowed to vote as individuals or apply for a job or what have you. All right? We talk about national self-determination. We're talking about something that only a people can achieve collectively, right? And you'll notice that in the United States, all the things that supposedly have been conceded to black people have been conceded to black people as individuals, so that when you look at the Constitution, there's no mention of the existence of an African-American nation inside of the United States. There's no mention of rights that nation has as a nation. For instance, the right to enough land to develop its national life, respect for that national life, a share of the power of the whole society based on that national existence. There is no recognition of the national character of black people, but African Americans inside the United States, in fact, constitute a nation.
Well, hi, Bill. This is Eric Mann.
How are you doing, Eric?
Good. Very nice to hear your voice, and I read the article in anticipation of the meeting. For what it's worth, we at the Strategy Center would share your perspective, which is, I think you know right now, a very small minority perspective. We wrote a common strategic document called Towards a Program of Resistance, and have been trying to raise the issue of the conditionality relationship of oppressed nationality people to the United States, trying to come up with agitational demands such as reparations, just
yes.
as one, or one we have is a Free the U.S. 2 million, on the grounds that the mass incarceration of black and Latino people goes beyond the jurisdiction of a specific state to be the wholesale incarceration of a people that must be brought to the United Nations, must be an international issue. But one of the things I wanted to ask you in reading your really excellent article is, doesn't it feel painful at times about what a true minority position this has become? At one point, I mean, I was there in CORE and SNCC and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Panthers were mass questions.
Exactly.
The issue of a black nation was not really being debated. The debate was, where was it? It was how many states, you know,
that's right.
Under what circumstances, by any means necessary, should we go for a referendum? The Panthers calling for a plebiscite, other people saying no, Republic of New Africa.
That's right.
Now, what's happened to this? We think this is still the future of the black liberation movement, but you must be going through a painful and difficult dynamic of trying to reconstruct the centrality of these set of arguments.
Well, I think we have to recognize some things. One, those demands were so right on that they introduced a severe response from the system. All right, they immediately triggered the assassination of Malcolm X. All right. And even when Dr. King, by 1968, you know, was in some sense coming closer to that notion that poor people in some way had to be sovereign in this country, they took him down. COINTELPRO, right, decimated the Panthers and other nationalist forces. And so we were pretty much on the road to building a movement for black liberation and uniting that movement with the worldwide anti-imperialist movement. And we lost that battle. I don't think we lost the war, but we lost that battle. And the organizations that carried that struggle forward were decimated. People were murdered. They were destroyed by agents provocateurs from within. Our own lack of sophistication and know-how contributed to the downfall. And so in many ways we have to start almost from scratch, because in the popular consciousness of African Americans in this society, you're absolutely right, that idea is not there. There's a generation that has grown up largely without it. It doesn't mean there are no people who carry it forward, but there are very, very few. And there's a general sense that if you do hold these kind of positions, you're jeopardized and you should stay away from them, and that's old hat and that's passé. And so we have to acknowledge that we've been in a battle and that we didn't win that battle.
Well, yeah, and I'll say that we just on a very minor level, we have a project called the Community Rights Campaign. And by that we mean the right of self-determination of the black and Latino community.
Yeah.
And we've taken up the issue of the prison system in Los Angeles as a way, like we have a questionnaire that we're bringing into some high schools. And we ask a group of young people, have you ever been in the criminal justice system? Have your parents already been in the criminal justice system? Have you been in foster care? Have you already been suspended from school or disciplined from school? And I think what we're going to see as a pre-assumption of the survey is the mass collective incarceration of black and Latino youth almost to reconstruct a caste system where a child, before they're almost born, is born into the kind of demands that can only be solved through self-determination. So one of the things we just wanted you to know a little bit is that we are trying, you know, there are people on the ground trying. And then also, you're trying by your continued writing and speaking. Given the conservativeness of many even black students today, what's it like at Seton Hall? Tell us a little bit about your efforts to try to change consciousness with students of all races, but in particular black and Latino students, and how you're doing with it.
Well, that's a question that could take hours, but let me struggle very hard to be quite brief. I would say we're fighting a rear guard action. First, we have a limited resource, and you can imagine the counteroffensive has diminished to a certain extent the number of faculty people, you know what I mean, that you have available, and the resources you have to bring people on campus or the resources you have to help students go off campus to do work. However, we are still here. You know, we have a black student union. We have an African Student Leadership Coalition. These groups are active, although small. They're hooked up to community-based organizations, and they do work in the area of reparations, in the area of the struggle for quality education, and even in terms of trying to build an anti-war effort on campus. But what you will find is that in higher education now, fewer and fewer of folks from inner-city poor neighborhoods can get to a place like Seton Hall. It's becoming more and more expensive. Some of our students have to drop out because they just can't pay the bill for the 5 or 6 or 7 years. Also, the kinds of things that you've just described that are happening to families, they happen to the families of people in college who have to leave, you know what I mean, to confront a family emergency, who have to take over the leadership of a family or be responsible for siblings when parents pass in untimely fashion. Or I've had students who've been busted, you know what I mean? And so they're not going to be able to continue education because they've gotten caught up in the criminal justice system. But this is an era where we have to continue to fight, and there are people and organizations like your efforts in Los Angeles all over the country. We're not completely dead. As I said, that energy at some level is still there. And it's on the basis of that energy interacting with our people in the concrete conditions that are worsening every second that we're going to rebuild this struggle, I do believe. And I think that, you know, the 21st century is going to be a century of transformation. I have no doubt. You know, it was interesting. Malcolm said, why you say that, you know, I'm a convict that I was in prison, right? Mm. But he said, we're all in prison. This is no, you know, more clearly seen than today, where almost every public institution that black folks find themselves in is an institution that actually wages war against them. You know, the educational system is designed to destroy our kids, to usher them into the criminal justice system, which is designed to destroy them. The foster care system is another system designed to destroy them, right? So all the systems that are set up supposedly to help us are really very sophisticated means for destroying us, both individually and also to destroy our collective identity as a people. This forces us to begin to think about how we can be self-reliant, how we can develop a base of power independent of the existing institutional structure in the society, especially as the society becomes much more a barbarian society, if I could use that terminology, a society that's in its terminal phase. You know what I mean? As a racial state and a capitalist enterprise, and so we can't even look to a reform of what exists as a solution, because the thing is falling apart. Perforce, it's going to fall upon us to be our own liberators, and I think, you know, that's the kind of message that Malcolm was carrying into the '60s, and it's one which still resonates today more than ever.
Well, joining us right now is William Sales. He is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Seton Hall University. You know, to carry on this issue that you're bringing forth, is this system is bankrupt. So let's talk about what we're going to put in its place. And, you know, in Malcolm's days towards the end, he was very friendly to the Cuban government.
Yeah.
When Fidel Castro came here, he was the one that hooked up the hotel space at Hotel Teresa, right?
Uh-huh.
He spoke very, he looked towards the Chinese Revolution, uh-huh. right? He looked towards Amilcar Cabral and the African
yeah.
Revolution.
Yeah.
So his roots later and later in his life became rooted much more in the socialist tradition.
Yes. Malcolm X is not in a formal sense a Marxist or a Marxist-Leninist, but he certainly had developed as an anti-capitalist, and he tapped into trends in the black liberation movement that go back a long way that one could say were more socialist than anything else. What's also important is that he saw that there was a worldwide movement, all right, against the hegemonic powers that were based, of course, in the United States. And he even used the terminology NATO. He identified NATO before we saw this more recent consolidation as the enemy, you know, of the world's emerging people. And he looked to the international arena for allies. Now, today, we know that some of those states that he looked to cannot play the role that they could, that they were playing, let's say, in the 60s, Cuba being, of course, a notable exception. But that doesn't mean that the international arena is not an area that should be cultivated. There are a whole lot of popular forces which are coalescing, you know, internationally, that African Americans definitely need to and have already to a certain extent plugged into. The worldwide movement for reparations is represented by the conference in Durban, which probably would have had even more momentum if it hadn't been for 9/11, but it is still there, that international energy to, in a sense, confront the West around the history of the slave trade, colonialism, and all forms of genocide associated with the expansion of Europe over peoples of color. There's also the international dialogues like Porto Alegre, and that motion has to be nurtured, and we have to plug into that, because we can't look to states per se for salvation. You know, it's not about getting a franchise from this progressive place or that progressive place or the other progressive place. But what it is very direct building of links between popular mass-based organizations that can struggle beyond national borders and across national borders against this expanding neo-imperialism which masquerades under the terminology of globalism.
Well, Bill, you know, we maybe just like each other because we speak such a common language. I did a book called Dispatches from Durban that was a little bit obliterated by September 11th, but you can get it on www.amazon.com about the World Conference Against Racism and post-September 11th movement strategies. And I think that you ended on a very positive note, which is I still think that the two things that are going on, one is the concept of barbarism. I mean, we don't throw words around lightly, but those of us who have lived in the United States have never seen it deteriorate towards barbarism, not since the age of slavery. And the second is the internationalism. And I think getting young people into these UN, World Social Forum, virtually anywhere outside into the third world is a tremendous consciousness-raising situation, because you see the people that are starving to death because the U.S. is selling bottled water and people can't afford their own water. You see people starving to death because the farm aid that goes to all these Midwest all-white states that then go into the third world and sell subsidized corn so that the person making corn in the third world can't even afford to buy their own. So I guess the last thing is that with, you know, I don't know if you were able to hear Howard Zinn's prior on the show, but it's also the role of intellectuals, yourself and Howard Zinn, keep preaching the gospel, and when they say don't preach to the choir, please do, because we don't got much of a choir, and we really need more preachers.
Well, you know, one thing I can say about the role of the intellectual is that we have to establish very strong organic links with the masses. This is also a very important lesson that Malcolm taught us. It's not an ivory tower function that we perform. You know, we have to be interacting with people in the community. We have to be lecturing in the community. We have to be listening in the community. We have to be doing our research and case studies popular struggles in motion in the community.
That's right.
And that's what's so important about the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Is that you are moving with people against the forces that oppress us. And if we're not in motion, if we're not struggling, then we can't learn. And if we can't learn, we'll never defeat them.
Thank you so much, William Sayles.
Okay.
Thank you. My pleasure. Okay. We'd like to thank our guests today, Howard Zinn and William Sayles, and our producer, Alan Minsky, and engineer, Maggie LaPique. See you next week. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman.
Voices from the Front Lines. Catch you next week.
Like America, see Bin Laden was trained by the CIA. But I guess if you a terrorist for the U.S., then it's okay.
They try to make us think we crazy.
Hey, you.